This is an oral interview with Mrs. Helen Gerasimo, taken as part of the Polar Oral History Project, conducted by the American Polar Society and the Byrd Polar Archival Program of The Ohio State University on a grant provided by the National Science Foundation. The interview was conducted at Mrs. Gerasimo's home in Beaverton, Oregon, by Brian Shoemaker on the 18th of April, 2000.
Okay, my name is Helen Gerasimo, and I was born in 1925, September 24th, in a little town called Mahanoy City, Pennsylvania. I went to a parochial school from first grade to eighth grade, then I went to a public high school. In high school, at my freshman year, I was elected as a representative to the Student Congress. In my sophomore year, I was represented also as a sophomore. And then in the third year, I was to the House of Representatives and the Senate together, and then I became the president of the Student Congress in my senior year.
Is this the House of Representatives, U.S. House?
No, it wasn't a visit, it's for
the high school,
yeah.
Okay.
All this occurred in the Mahanoy City High School in Mahanoy City, Pennsylvania. I graduated in June 1943. From there, I went to Washington, D.C. after having taken a civil service examination for a position right after World War II began. I felt this need personally because my mother had adopted two children, and they were both killed in Pearl Harbor, one at Schofield Barracks and the other one at Pearl Harbor itself. And this frustrated the family and was about to tear it apart. Although there were five children, she then took on an added job of raising her sister's six children, who ranged from 10 months to 10 years old, because she promised her they wouldn't be separated and put in an orphanage. Those boys all served in the military service. This made my mother and father feel very proud. We supported each other, me away from them, for one whole year before I came back to visit them. I called them about every other week to let them know how things were going. When I went to the Pentagon building tour the first time, I was making the salary of $1,174 a year.
You began to work at the Pentagon. That was your first job.
First job at the Pentagon.
Who did you work for?
I worked for Department of the Army. And the position was as secretary, doing typing and shorthand and filing and whatever else was necessary, and worked with all military personnel.
This, did you know General Marshall?
Yes. Yes. I will explain later in this interview about my personal meeting with General Marshall, because they were under different circumstances which one would never realize at the time. My first problem was learning military rank. Because when somebody would come to the office and ask for my boss, I had to look at his shoulders and see what he was wearing. So I had to look at the chart and say, oh, he's a captain. That's two silver bars. Okay. The full colonel is the one with the bird on. Okay, fine. The silver one, that was a lieutenant colonel. Well, I got that straight. The generals are one of different things. They're a lot simpler. One stars, two stars, etc. This became a joke, but at least one thing, it worked and everybody was happy with it. Right. Okay, I was assigned to an Army captain. He was from New Orleans, Louisiana, in Baton Rouge. The director of our program was a dean of men from Louisiana, who was also military.
Which program was it?
Think of what the hell they called it.
Okay. That doesn't matter.
It was the ordnance section of the Department of the Army. We were asked to keep an account of ammunition spent by military men per man per day. This was a request that came from the Hill, this Congressional Hill, Margaret Chase Smith, whom I have admired because anyone who kept that position in armed forces and was re-elected year after year and only spent $500 on her campaign. She's also noted as the only woman that I've ever found out in the Congress who sat there with a rose on her dress every day. We worked on all kinds of projects like this, and also we're tuned in on the difference between rifles, shotguns, flamethrowers, so we would know the nomenclature. Then I was transferred to another section with quartermaster, and from there we had personnel movements, and there we had war-ready room for the Pentagon. And that was a classified section. During my stay in the Department of the Army, I was transferred later through a promotion to the Department of Defense. At that time, I had established myself as a good secretary and transcriber, and I was called to many meetings. I had attained a standing of top secret for the U.S. military and most secret for the British. My first encounter with foreign military personnel were with the officers who came training in the Pentagon from different countries. A language barrier presented itself. There's nothing much I could have done about that because time was of an essence. But we somehow managed to understand each other. I stayed in that position until from June 17, 1943 to 1946. The position was abolished due to demobilization. I then transferred, got a job the very next day at War Assets Administration. I stayed at that organization from June 10, 1946 to June 7, 1947. I worked for the special agent in charge, Mr. Edward P. Guinane, G-U-I-N-A-N-E. Headquarters were in Washington, D.C. This was an organization that came into being when the war was over and we had a backload of military surplus equipment that had to come back to the States. We found out that black market was very heavy and found out also that in the port of Baltimore there was some hanky-panky going on there, and the agents got together and we went down there to take notes, and they performed what is now known commonly as a sting operation. There were jeeps, firearms, vehicles of all kinds, military, being bought and sold left and right. May I say at this time, to countries that were not friendly with the United States. The woman who was in charge of this group had built herself quite an organization. In other words, the equipment came right off the boat at the port and suddenly disappeared. A sting operation took place, and we confiscated all the equipment, all the warehouses, the countries at the port of entry and export under false papers and also false packaging, and they were all later taken care of by the judges. We broke up that one successfully. After I stayed with them for a while and things were going along pretty fine, there came time for us to be dispersed. We all went to different organizations. I went and applied for the first time to a civilian job. I became secretary to Mr. H.G. Lombard, L-O-M-B-A-R-D. He was a patent attorney. And offices were at 14th and F Street, Northwest National Press Building, Washington, D.C. from June 7, 1947 to August 21, 1950. However, at the outbreak of the Korean War, Mr. Lombard, being a Navy officer and being in reserve as a commander, was called back. I closed up the office, dismantled it, and sent all the data to Tenement Products Incorporated of Cayuga Falls, Ohio.
What was his business?
He was a patent attorney. During my time spent with Mr. Lombard, I made searches at the patent office for inventions and ideas and patent and trademarks. This was my first association with something known as a credit card. It was the first one. I'm happy to say that at this age of 75 presently, even though I typed up and sent the data to the patent office, I have never had a credit card in my life and I don't intend to start at this age. It didn't work out that well because I could see now, if I'd have known then what I know now, oh boy, I would discourage people from signing up for them. After Mr. Lombard's departure, I was again without a job. So I applied to the Department of Defense. I went down and took a test, Civil Service Commission. The results of the test were I was top. Nobody could get promoted or sign until I moved. The first proposition came to me as Assistant Personnel Officer at Andrews Air Force Base. I didn't think of traveling from Washington, D.C., where I lived, all the way out to Andrews Air Force Base and back. So I looked for something closer. I went down to the Ben Franklin Post Office, and across the street there was a building that housed personnel application people. They gave me the folder and the file and says, find yourself a job. I looked through it and found out there was one about three blocks from where I lived called the National Science Foundation. That organization was in the process of moving down from 2300 California Street in Washington, D.C., Northwest area, to the old Cosmos Club, close to the White House and across the street from Lafayette Park. I stayed with them from June 14, 1954, in several different positions till I retired 12/28/1979.
Who did you work for first?
Okay, I'm coming to that. The first application that was accepted was in the Division of Biology and Medicine. And I worked for Dr. Louis Levin, L-E-V-I-N, who at that time in the foundation was the only medical doctor on the staff. He was an endocrinologist. We worked well together, and I was also asked to assist in the genetics, chemistry, and two other junior organizations. We had moved down from the Cosmos Club to G Street, 1800 G Street Northwest, which is about a block and a half away from the White House. It seems that this location was precisely what the foundation wanted, something closer to the White House, and we were lucky enough to get that. There I went from Division of Biology and Medicine to the National Science Foundation, Dr. Thomas O. Jones. At that time, we were just building up, and we got people from the Navy Department, which was right across the street on Constitution Avenue.
Now, this was Office of Polar Programs, or you were assigned to Tom Jones before he went there?
No, I was assigned to Tom Jones.
At the Office of Polar Programs?
Yes.
Okay. This was of what date?
Oh, just a minute.
I'm just curious as to when they Office of Polar Programs, yeah.
I came to them on August 28, 1959. I stayed with them until 12/28/79.
Now go ahead, just keep talking.
Dr. Jones asked me if I would take dictation from the men who have been down the Antarctic and came back, and I did. First time I took dictation on polar programs was from George Tony. That followed Phil Smith, Ken Moulton, Harry Francis. I'm trying to think of the other guy's name. It wasn't until sometime later that they expanded and got a couple more people on board. Mort Turner. He was Mr. Mort Turner at the time. And he handled geology. Dr. Jones had asked me to work in the science section where I'd been. We moved to another office space, and I was asked to work with Jack Kroll, John T. Kroll.
And he Kroll? How do you spell that?
C-R-O-W-E-L-L. He was the one who was going to get a vessel for the polar programs. And that was the one, I should say, the birth of the U.S. Eltanen. I was very happy and excited about handling this part of the job, because from my desk in Washington, D.C., to Maine, where the ship was being refitted and built and whatnot, and later it was christened, the ceremony, the decoration of the platform, the running back and forth of Dr. Crary, going up there and checking out everything with John Kroll, never left the desk. It launched. Then it was time for personnel. Well, we had to go and look for personnel on the ship. There was a shakedown cruise from Maine up to the Arctic area and came down. The crew started to complain about the food. The food was okay. However, they were on desserts. They were mad because from four desserts they got down to two desserts a day, and they didn't think that was enough. So I said to Dr. Jones, where will the ship be when it comes back? I said, you know, it would be great if we could have it down here in Washington on the Potomac River. Never thinking that, you know, that idea from me would go through anywhere. Finally, the day came, and they brought it down. We had open house. So we tried to talk Dr. Jones into trying a weather balloon. Well, it was funny because the weather was fine. The balloon was ready to go, and he almost went with it. He forgot to let go. It was embarrassing, but it was funny, and I said, well, that's a good way to get rid of the boss, if we ever had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so comical. But the people and the staff, everybody from the foundation, want to come down to see how could a little organization like the Polar Programs get a vessel. That was really fun.
So Kroll planned it and commissioned it.
It was...
Did he get some help from the Navy? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. At the time, I was introduced to Davisville, Rhode Island. Never been up there, but did meet Tom Armstrong, who was our representative up there. He was the one who helped get all the equipment together for us and get it down to the Antarctic. When we moved to 1800 G Street, to bigger office, we had more space, more programs. Dr. Crary had an office of his own and his own secretary. Phil Smith, likewise, Ken Moulton, George Tony. Then we took on an information officer, Mr. Kurt Sandved, S-A-N-D-V-E-D. Then we hired a cartographer from the U.S. Geological Survey, Walter R. Seelig, S-E-E-L-I-G. We had Eddie Goodale's son-in-law, Robert Hinchcliffe, H-I-N-C-H-L-I-F-F-E, who worked with projects on the Altana. Mr. Hinchcliffe moved a short time later to Walnut, California. In his place, we received Colonel Merle Dawson, D-A-W-S-O-N.
And what was his job?
Colonel Dawson was a master. He could take any ship, any weight, anywhere in the world, licensed for that. He came to us after he had did the evacuation in South Korea. Through mine-infested waters. Colonel Dawson and I collaborated on an Antarctic manual, survival manual. There was one in the polar programs, but it was a loose-leaf binder. It was too big, too bulky to carry around. We started with instructions of survival. Colonel Dawson and I worked on this book together, and we got it down to a size that would fit in a jacket pocket, which is about 6 by 8 inches. We had survival, the do's and don'ts at every station we had at the time. It proved to be a very good publication.
When you were assigned to Tom Jones, he'd just been assigned the job as director of support programs, is that correct?
Right.
And were you the first person assigned to him? I mean, was there anybody else in the department?
They were, but they weren't polar programs. They were the front office.
Well, this was the main part of NSF proper.
Yeah.
The head office.
Yeah.
Okay, and then Tom eventually split off, got his own division,
of polar
which
programs.
Became the Office of Polar Programs.
Right. Uh-huh.
So you were with him before the creation of Office of Polar Programs.
Yes.
I see.
Because I'd taken dictation with Libby Hunt, mm-hmm. who worked for Dr. Joyce, J-O-Y-C-E. Wally Joyce. And they had a lot to do with SCAR organization. And one of the first subcontractors out was Arctic Institute of North America. They were the ones who organized the I gotta think of what the name they call it now, just a minute. Skyline orientation programs, which were held in Shenandoah National Park. It was usually about the first couple of days, maybe a week after Labor Day.
Okay. Back to Tom. Now, where did Tom come from? I mean, what did he do before he started Office of Polar Programs?
I know we got Ken from the Navy. We got Kurt Sandved from the Office of Information. Walter Seeley we got from Geological Survey, because I had to write up a job sheet for him, and I thought, I never wrote up one for a cartographer, a chart maker, anybody like that. And Eddie Goodale came from the U.S. Weather Bureau. he was USARP representative in Christchurch, New Zealand. And he had a secretary there, Margaret Lanyon, L-A-N-Y-O-N, who stayed with Eddie for the whole time.
How many years was Eddie in Christchurch?
Every year.
Every summer season, huh?
Every summer season.
And for how long? How many years?
Oh, God. Not only summer season. When the station closed, he came to Washington, D.C. to work in our office, and then he went back somewhere in August, so that he would he had established the warehouse for the clothing, because under the contract with Arctic Institute of North America, the clothing was in a warehouse, and it was fixed up in bundles and brought up to Shenandoah National Park on the last day or two of orientation, and was given out to the guys who were going down the ice. And we eliminated that part of the business because it was kind of cumbersome. And if there was, exchanges of clothing, you had to tell these people that, the clothing is different if you're going to be in a hut or if you're going to be on a camp out in the field. And there's a difference between the summer and a winter issue. So it was much, much better to work it this way. We came up with a form. I had asked the people to, if I could have someone from the administrative office of the National Science Foundation who did forms and publications and whatnot. And this worked out very well because we came up with a 3-page form. Then we decided, cut it down to 2-page. And that first page would be your information, your next of kin and who you are, where you are, and whatnot. And if you have any dependents while you will be down in the Antarctic, who will take care of them? And a very funny one was the first one was from a geologist from a university who said, "My parents will take care of my dog," which I thought was ironic. And all the information was on one sheet of paper, front and back. The second sheet of paper was nothing but the clothing. Now that was interesting because you would be surprised how many people never knew what size they wore. So we had to start measuring them. And that's when we got some mannequins and we had them put out in the hallway right before you enter the office. And they had a guy in a summer outfit, and a field outfit, and then a wintering over outfit.
This was at NSF or...
Yeah,
at NSF.
Yeah, at NSF.
So,
the first week
they
was
would know when they came in.
They knew they were in the right place.
Now, who were your science officers? Mort Turner was geology, you mentioned.
Okay. Dr. Crary covered a lot of fields.
Mm-hmm.
Mort Turner became...
When did Crary come along? After IGY?
Yes, because he was associated with Krill, and they had a big farewell to do for Bert Crary when he left Krill and came to the foundation. He became the chief scientist.
When was that he came? 60?
Yeah, about that time. And he not only took care of going down to the Antarctic, he took care of the Arctic, he took care of people on the ship. Merle Dawson was responsible for the Eltanen. Took it out on many cruises.
Merle
Dawson,
huh?
D-A-W-S-O-N.
He was the skipper of the Eltanen?
Yep. Until they finally got, they got a permanent one. Meanwhile...
Was that Ed Thornton?
Yeah. I think there was somebody else before him.
Did you know Ed lives here?
A foreigner that I don't recall his name.
Peter Lenning?
Yeah.
Peter was on the Hero.
No, he was on the Hero, no. I can't think of him. But anyway, the men all had to take a tour duty, not only down the ice, but they had to go on the ship too. And the Eltanen, Ken Moulton took it from Wellington, New Zealand to Ushuaia. George Tony was on him, because his request to me is, don't send them too young, he said. I have to burp them and carry them aboard the ship, he said, when they get seasick. Phil Smith was. Bert Crary was. Bert Crary went down the ice almost every year. Mm-hmm. I want to insert an incident that took place regarding Bert Crary and embarrassment to myself, because these bunch of guys never told me a little bit of background about who was coming on board. I had to dig that out myself. So when Dr. Jones decided that we ought to have a new survival manual, and so at the meeting, at the staff meeting, he suggested who we could talk to, some old Antarctic explorers, and about the problems they had and if we could avoid any danger. So I suggested Dr. Crary, and everybody at the table just roared. And I didn't think that was funny. I didn't want to embarrass Dr. Crary, but I do know why I embarrassed myself. Because then the incident came up about, well, he, just the best one I thought would be surfing, with all the knowledge on survival, and it turned out that he was out on an ice cap that broke off. And everybody went to his rescue, and of course, you know, they couldn't, the helicopters were already were being backloaded, you know, and it was the end of the season, and there was Dr. Crary, and evidently the chaplain of Our Lady of the Snows down in McMurdo Station, he was more concerned with Bert's, you know, where was going to happen, you know, how are we going to get him off the ice and everything, and so finally, he saw that he was praying and all, and so finally, the question came up as, well, I guess if you feel like you're going to die or something, you know, you're going to ask the Almighty to help you. And so when I asked Dr. Crary, is this true? He said, yes. And I said, did you pray? And he said, sort of. And he said, it was hell, shit. How am I going to get off there? And
he was on a piece of ice.
He was on a piece of ice. And so one of the guys who were down there was a relative of Harry Francis's. He threw this life preserver out. He got it out there, but he hit Bert Crary with it. Bert collapsed on the ice. They finally got a helicopter together and out there to rescue him. But it was a close call. Another time, at the incident, they decided to play baseball one day, and so they decided to have a baseball field made out of the ice. Everything was fine, and when it got time to hit the sack, there was a terrific rumble. And I found out that it cracked, the field went out, they had to scatter and run to get off that particular part. I realized then what a dangerous place it was. The foundation made grants to colleges and universities to support research down the Antarctic. Solved a lot of problems, but we get a lot of inquiries about, well, how could we preserve our specimens? And I told him, if you can't do it in the Antarctic, you will never do it anyplace else. At this time, the universities had chosen their people. Grants were made, people were assigned, ready to go down.
There was a thing. Did they get them together for an organizational meeting or anything
after
they did that? Where was that?
Shenandoah National Park, every year.
What was that called?
Orientation Program. National Science Foundation Orientation Program for Polars.
And was that Skyline?
Skyline. Skyline Drive, Shenandoah National Park.
Okay.
Now that's where...
Now how many people went there? Everybody who went to the ice or all the scientists?
Over 200.
Military come?
Absolutely. They were assigned places to live, cabins. We try to keep them together, so we figure this way, psychologically and mentally, the summer people would live in the same building with the military people. So they would know one another, and in all due respects, I brought up the subjects, well, you know, if you don't like the guy, the way he combs his hair, and then find out when he takes his hat off, he's bald-headed. You bought the farm. So you learn to get together up at Skyline. the orientation program. If you can't make it up there, you're sure as hell you're not going to make it down the ice. That goes for summer and winter and even field. So this worked out very well.
How long did they hold Skyline conferences?
We had it for 2 weeks, and then we cut it down to 1 week. And we got speakers who came, like Al Wade. He showed pictures and slides and whatnot, Tony Gow. We picked some very good people that came, and they were the bulk, sort of, the adhesive factor that kept the whole thing together.
Did they continue these?
Every year, like clockwork.
Till forever? I asked that because they were doing them in the 60s when I was there, but I returned in the 80s when I was commander, and they weren't.
No, they weren't then. I don't know what they did after I left. But while I was there, we would go up.
So they did it through 79 then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Because we had it up there all the time. But then, you know, when the ship came along, we didn't want them to be like orphans in the storm. So we decided that a Friday would be the day when the El Tannen people would come up and the Hero people. Because we didn't want to have any problems in any foreign countries, and stressed upon them that you're going down there, number one, you have to be physically fit, mentally alert.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was the one who scheduled personnel for medical and physical examinations. I contacted Navy bases, military bases around. If there was an Army base in Kansas or Wyoming, the people from the University of Wyoming would go there.
So you sent them to military bases for their physicals?
For the physical examination. Then I talked to the doctors on the phone, wrote them letters, sent them the formats, told them, fill them out, their dental work, and everything. And their shots. From that group, from each station, that was all the ones who would be working down at South Pole Station, McMurdo Station, Bird Station, Eights, Sipo. There was one pick there who would be the SSL, which was the station scientific leader.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked some real good guys there. I mean, their heart and soul was in it.
Who were some of these guys?
John Katsifrakis for the summer. He was
and
down.
Was that which station?
South Pole.
Is that Sipo?
No, it's Sipo. Trying to think of who the heck was at Sample. Wish I had saved those lists. Because
that's okay,
it
doesn't matter. I know Katsifrakis.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the young man who was Jerry Coyman.
Coyman?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with the biology program out of California.
He's down at Scripps now.
Yeah. And, Charlie Roberts, who was a Navy officer, worked with the Weather Bureau, and he was also an EMT man. Mm-hmm. Emergency medical technician. We had him at South Pole Station time and time again. He stayed for the summer, and I think he wintered over a couple of times. From Ohio State, we had Art Rundle at Palmer Station. He stayed there summer, winter, summer. Came back, went down the following year.
Was he the first?
Yeah.
That was about 64 or 5, wasn't
mm-hmm.
it?
And he came back and went up to have a physical examination at Bethesda Naval Hospital in Washington, D.C. And they looked at his records and everything and said, well, hell, there's nothing wrong with you. They did him a quick examination. He went down again. During that summer, winter, and summer, broke for a while there. And so we'd give him time in Chile
mm-hmm.
or Argentina, you know, but R&R. Because at that time, you know, we had the Chileans who wanted to, the Argentinians, they wanted to establish their stations. They brought over wives, babies born there and everything, and it had, this territorial position business cropped up again. And I, the best person who I worked with on that was Paul Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
He lived up in Maine, and then he went down to Louisiana in the winter. But Paul was he was ambassador to several European countries, and he was also on the board at the Organization of American States.
So you knew Paul Daniels?
Yes.
Of course, he negotiated the Antarctic Treaty.
Treaty, right, absolutely.
But you say he came back, and did he do inspections?
Oh, yes.
And so he did inspect other nations' stations down in Antarctica.
Right.
Did he ever make a Russian inspection, do you know?
I don't know offhand.
Mm-hmm. But he did do inspections of others.
Yes, we had the scientists from the foundation, the polar programs, also had, you know, besides taking a tour on the ship and going down for the summer, they would change it. We had a big turnaround. Because we didn't like to send them down every year, one, you know, the same year, give them a break to stay and take another station for the summer rather than wintering over. We had an exchange program with the foreign scientists.
How did that work?
Excellent.
I mean, what were the mechanics of making it work? Did we make the...
The polar programs made it with the Russian Academy of Sciences. The National Academy of Sciences helped us. Lou DeGos of the National Academy of Sciences here in Washington, D.C., got in touch with Dr. Gerasimov, G-E-R-A-S-I-M-O-V. He was head of the Russian Academy of Sciences. They had sent down Dr. Tereshnikov, T-R-E-S-H-N-O-K-O-V.
You know what his first name was?
Can't think of his first name. It'll come to me though, I know that. Because he had a secretary, Anna, and I have introduced her to Dr. Untersteiner when she came to Washington, D.C. for a visit. I know he would prepare a barbecue mm-hmm. or something for him. But anyway, then there was another Russian who came to serve when Harry Francis went over to the Vostok station. He came over at McMurdo station.
Francis wintered over at Vostok? When? What year was that?
I think it was a year or so after Little America. We did the same with the Japanese at their station. I think it was Soya, S-W-O-Y-A. And we had a contact, like Eddie Goodale's job in New Zealand. We had one like that with Peter Welkner down in Ushuaia, who took care of the troops that we sent down, when, you know, the scientists, the ones on the ship, the ones going to Palmer Station. Worked close with the American Embassy down there, as we had a transfer of funds.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, there was a big controversy about the exchange of money, you know, but we got over that one really good. I don't know where Tom Jones came from, but I do know that Bert Currie came from Krill, mm-hmm. because they were reluctant to really let him go. But that's how I became friends with all those guys up at the Krill. Tony Gallo is my favorite. High score drilling.
So Bert came over from Krell, and he mm-hmm. was up in the Arctic before that.
Yes, yes.
What was he doing up in the Arctic?
I have no
idea. Mm-hmm. And Tom, you were assigned to Tom, and he was already with NSF proper.
Right.
And he was given orders to start the Office of Polar Programs in 1959.
Right, and out comes all these people, Ken Moulton, come over. And
How did you get them? Did you write them letters, say, would you like to join NSF?
He picked up the phone and called me. We were right across the street.
Who was across the street? I mean, they were at...
The Navy Department was like across the street, and the foundation mm-hmm. was that on Constitution Avenue.
I see.
Because when we moved from the Cosmos Club, we moved to another temporary place that was up on... across from the doctor's hospital,
mm-hmm.
which is in about the same block, but we needed more space because we're up on the third floor and it was an attic.
Mm-hmm.
And from there we moved to Constitution Avenue.
18th and G?
No, 2000 Constitution Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And from there we got in this new building that they finished. It's on the television here, where these right across the street from the International Monetary Fund.
So you didn't have a home for a while. You kind of bounced around.
Yeah.
It was just the two of you, or
no,
then
no,
all
no.
these guys.
All these guys, yeah.
So they finally, when did they move into 18th and G?
Oh. It would have to be about 57 or 58, somewhere there.
Okay.
See, because when I worked at the Cosmos, the old Cosmos Club,
mm-hmm.
the National Science Foundation had 109 people on one sheet of paper. That was our telephone book. We had two extension
digits. That was the entire National Science Foundation.
That's right.
That
we had 24 and 27 were the Polar Program.
So the Office of Polar Programs formed in 1959, you say.
Yeah.
And you were already at 18th and G.
Uh-huh.
You were. Okay, I understand. And so they pretty much stayed there on the sixth floor of 18th and G from then on.
Till I retired.
Till you retired, and okay.
79.
That's 18th and G Northwest, right? Uh-huh. So Bert, did he go into the field and do research anymore after he was with the NSF staff?
He went down to work with the guys from Corps, from Krill, I mean, Tony Gow and them. And then he went down in the summertime for the summer season with, we had Bert Currie, Fiorenzo Ugolini, who came from Rutgers University.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a couple of Germans. There were five different countries there. They all raised their flags, and I said, the Bert, since you raised an American flag, they didn't have one, so I shipped them down one. And they were there for the summer in the geology. George Domani was there. And
this was out where? That was
it
in
was
the,
one of the field.
One of the geology field camps?
Yeah, one of the field camps, because when the weather was bad, they became the best pinochle players I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil Smith, and then went. They've been down on a couple of traverses over to the Russian station, and with the Russians on board. And the Russians just lived on potatoes and cabbage soup. My guys didn't like that at all. So they introduced the American food to them. Then they built an open disciple station, which was a new one. And they wanted, there wasn't room enough to have a big extensive program there of changed scientists, but they did go work with them on the traverses, because that's, you know, they lived in these vehicles across the ice. And Merle Dawson went down there and picking the site for a disciple station. He came up with the idea that we ought to get something like an ice detector, and it goes out on the front vehicle, because when the Navy was down, a crevasse opened and swallowed this tractor with the driver,
mm-hmm.
and killed him, and we had to wait until the spring or the summer season to get him out. But the chaplain come out there and blessed him and buried him, and we finally, George Tony brought the body back with him when he got off the ice into Andrews, and then we shipped it to his next of kin. But we had to get something to detect them, because Merrill said, he said, you could hear it crack, and he said, and it's, you know, you just can't figure out what the weather's going to be like, the changes in it. I had some field parties when Bill Austin was in there with a couple of guys, and they put snow blocks all over the tent. They damn near blew the tent off the continent. The winds came up that hard. And then at the same time, I was cussing out Eddie Bauer, who was supposed to send me down tents, and he sent the ones that leaked. And I really jumped over him. And when I got to meet him and he opened up all these sporting goods stores, I told him, I said, how the hell are you ever staying in business when you don't know one tent from another?
You mean that was before he became famous? Hmm. And he made tents for us in the Antarctic? What, he got the contract for that? Did he make the Scott tents that we use today?
Yeah. But he learned the lesson the hard way, because I told him, I said, never, 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 never. I said, you put them in a damn wind tunnel and turn it up as far and as high as you can. Mm-hmm. I said, we almost lost these guys.
Did you work with Joe Fletcher?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. When did Joe take over from Tom Jones? Did Tom retire? Was that
no, it? Tom went to the front office. He was in administration. All the programs, Joe Fletcher came in. Joe came down from the Rand Corporation up in Seattle, Washington. And Fletcher Island, before that, up in the Arctic. And then also on the staff of the University of Washington in Seattle.
Okay. How was Joe, how was he different from Tom?
Well, Tom Jones made several trips down to the Antarctic, but I mean, he wasn't a guy who was out there in the field working, you know, pick and shovel stuff.
Mm-hmm.
As I taught the guys down there, I said, you get down to South Pole Station, I said, and it's your turn to shovel snow. I said, shovel it or you're not going to have enough water to drink, or I said, enough to take a bath in. And I said, if the enlisted men want to not take a bath for weeks and roll in the snow, then I said, fine, because they established a polar club. They made a sweat station thing.
Mm-hmm.
They'd go out there stark naked, run in, then go in there and take a shower and whatnot, and that what the polar club was, whatever,
so
98
Jones,
below zero.
Jones didn't go into the field much, and Fletcher was different, huh?
Yeah.
How so?
Because he established Fletcher Island.
Well, I understand, but how so was he when he was in the Antarctic job with the people? I mean, did he work with them in the field?
Pick and shovel.
Mm-hmm. So he went out and he communed with the scientists.
He did there, and then he
camps.
Went from station to station. He went there down and made a trip around all the stations. Then he went out to the field at camp, the Minnesota Boys there with Bob Rutherford,
mm-hmm.
and Jim Zumberg, who was a member of the National Science Board at the time, and so was Al Wade. But Al Wade would go down with his gang every year.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the knowledge in the background of what, you know, two different polar regions. You know, the Arctic is different than the Antarctic. You could have fires in both places, but when I first learned about how a hut could catch on fire down in the Antarctic, the snow being cellular, you cannot compact it. You got to shovel, you know, cut it in blocks and shovel it off. So we had those kind of up at the orientation program. One afternoon, we'd start a fire with teepees and have the guys go down. And one would use the Z sectionite that with the Ansel tanks to clear a passage to go in. The guy behind him didn't so much concentrate on the fire as he did on the guy in front of him. And he sloshed him with Ansel. Because you turn around and like Ron McGregor told me, he said, well, the damn fire was out. He said, but it got through, the snow was cellular. It got through there. He said, it come up right on your backside. And he said, I'll be damned if I'm going to have my backside burned. So I said, Ron, I said, we're going to have one of these demonstrations. He said, I'm coming up. Harry Francis was up there. He did mountain climbing. He taught them how to rappel up and down. And we did it with the pretending somebody was in a basket and everything, and had to get it down. We had a mountain climbing session up there. We had a, flew up a gang from New Zealand, from their stations, and they did a search and rescue mountain climbing too.
Well, how did Fletcher in his management technique at the foundation, did he reorganize things after Tom Jones in his own manner, or did he?
He made improvements. Everybody that came in that position made improvements. The only ones who didn't were the one like Ed Todd, who was there after Fletcher left and after Bob Rutherford left. And they were different because Todd never went down to the polar programs. I mean, he never went down to the ice until he joined the polar programs. And I said, you've got to go down there and see what it is. I said, I could tell you, I could show you pictures and slides, but I said, you've got to go down there and see it. And he did. And he stayed there for a couple of months, and he came back. And so he knew, because I said, you've got to get the feeling. I said, things are not as easy. Why can't we get this here? Why can't we get this here? I had a run-in with Tom Jones one day at a staff meeting. I didn't attend a staff meeting because I wasn't invited. But they were going over the budget. And we're trying to cut corners as much as we could, but yet save lives. So I had a call from Tom Armstrong, and he said, you know, he said, they're building the new McMurdo station. I said, yes. He said, you know, he said, we're going to need some beds and everything like that. And I said, I got the idea. I said, where could we get beds? I said, beds and mattresses that go with them and everything. And he said, well, you know, he said, the word up here is that the Fort Devens, Massachusetts, it's going to close. And I said, fine. What have they got? Anything for sale? And he said, well, he said, they're not selling them. But he said, we could get them. He said, we could work out a deal, get them. He said, all we have to do is pay the freight charges. I said, okay. So finally, we went ahead and planned, and we got the bunks, and we got 50 mattresses. And it comes up on there, on the bill of lading, and Tom Jones calls, and he says, Helen's been shopping again. And I says, what's the problem? And he says, who told you you could spend $1,900 and some dollars? I said, I didn't spend $1,900 and some dollars. He says, well, the mattresses, he said, and the beds, he said, are down McMurdo Station. I said, yes. He said, how'd you get them? I said, I paid $19.95, and if you want a receipt for it, I said, I'll give you the $20 now, and you can keep the change. He said, what? I said, it was just finagling. I said, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. He said, who did this? And I said, me and Tom Armstrong. If you want to fire him, fine. He goes, I go too. But I said, the world will know and long remember what goes on here.
Tom was in the front office?
Yeah.
Well, tell me about Rutherford. Compare
Bob
him to Joe Fletcher, who he followed.
A younger version.
A younger version of Joe Fletcher?
No, a younger version of a polar man, old Antarctic explorer. His heart and soul, he ate the stuff.
Fletcher did. You mean he...
No, not Fletcher. Fletcher didn't eat the stuff.
Uh-huh. Or Rutherford did.
Rutherford comes in. Before he came in, and we were looking around for somebody to be replace Fletcher, because Fletcher went to NOAA, it bothered me because there were some promotions from within thought they ought to get it, and I said no. I thought this because I said somebody has got to have. I went to Dr. Crary and I said to him, you know what? I said, do you want that job? And he says, no, hell. And he says, I don't want it. I says, okay. I says, well, this is what I'm going to do. I said, I think I ought to go down and talk to the director of the National Science Foundation, the number one man. And he and I became very good friends. I don't know how, but we did.
Who's the director then?
Oh, Alan Waterman and I were very good friends when I first went to the foundation. I helped him put on his kilts and whatnot, and I held his damn bagpipes while he played for the Christmas party. And then I said, "What are we going to do?" And I said, "You just play these songs here. You know them." He said, "I've been studying them fine." And out of all the program directors from the whole foundation, roll up their pants legs and did a can-can dance in the auditorium for it. But Dr. Waterman was very nice. He was the case of the mountain coming to Mohammed.
All right. So anyway, you Rutford, went to him and how'd they wind up selecting Rutford? Rutford was quite young.
Yes. That was the only thing that I said, but the man's got it up here where it's needed. I said, number one, he's well educated. Number two, he's been on many, many runs down to the Antarctic, I said, with field party, on traverses and everything. So I said, we need somebody that, I said, besides, I said, my one thing I want is somebody there who has an earned PhD. Like I said, Dr. Query, not like an honorary and not a bought one, you know what I mean? He said, good idea. So I said, I don't know who to pick. So then at the National Science Board, it came up, and Jim Zumber was a member of the National Science Board. Before him was Connie Elvium, who was head of the University of Minnesota. Conrad Elvium, when he died, Zumberg took over. Mm-hmm. Then Zumberg, we chose him as a National Science Foundation board member. So he comes up, and he is highly recommended by Rutford. When Rutford came in, it was a situation where you're turning a man who was a field man and you're turning him into an administrator. But I said, you know, if we work this together, you could be both. He said, is it possible? I said, absolutely. I said, I'd done it with a military man, and I said, when I was in the Department of Defense, and I said, I could do it with you. So he said, well, there's a lot I don't know, Helen. I said, I'll tell you what. I said, we'll do these letters together. I said, and I'll tell you what the weaknesses are, and I'm going to tell you about the grants. And I said, you sign the letters, then I'll explain it to you later. And we did this for about a year, and it got to be so good. But what Rutford did is he didn't want to have any closed doors. So when he came to the program, he took the doors off all the hallways coming down so he could run from one to the other without no doors are going to be stopped or shut in his face. And we did this, and we got along fine.
How about Rutford and Ed Todd? How did they, what was the change? Rutford leaves, Ed Todd comes in.
Todd came from a meteorology outfit down the line that didn't know beans about the Antarctic.
Was he already with NSF?
He was with NSF, yes. Okay. But he had nothing to do with the polar. The closest thing he came to polar that there was a reorganization down there, and there was a climatology department established, and Dr. Jones thought it would be good if I went down there and established it for him. And I said, I'm not going to leave my job here. I said, I got a cushiony job. And he said, we got to get this together. He said, we're going to get a meteorologist. He said, there's a damn smart man coming in from, he's from out of the country. I says, how far out? And he said, he's from Australia. I said, oh, geez. I said, okay. He said, his name is Dr. Uwe Radok, R-A-D-O-K. Mm-hmm. He's one of a twin. They're both meteorologists, only he's a couple of minutes older than his brother and smarter. And he ran the meteorology thing for the Australians. The Australian National Antarctic Program down there, ANARE, A-N-A-R-E. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Radha comes up. And so he said, we told him about this, and he said, well, he said he needs some help. He said he don't know these people. So we got our heads together, and I went down there and I talked to the secretary, and she's Italian, and I say this because she runs a very hard shop, a kind of a female mafia. As a matter of fact, she had a sign behind her back, it was on a wall calling the godmother, and I trained her. They chose the members to be on their panel. I appointed them all, indoctrinated them all, and they established a climatology department. And Dr. Radek and I then sat down, and he says, if we work this well together, he says, I have a book, he said, on climate, he said, and I wanted to get it translated. I said, what language is it in? He said, it's in German. I said, I don't know German. He says, I know German. I said, fine. I'll work with you on it. We did a book. We did the drawings.
Mm-hmm.
All the translations, we published the book. The book was called Climate Dynamics.
So Ed was a weather guy too then. And he came to the NSF.
Not as deep.
Yeah,
not,
but he came to NSF, and then he came down to Office of Polar Programs.
Right, right.
By
then, you know,
you talked about Rutherford opening all the doors so that he'd have access to everyone.
He knew.
What did Todd do that put his stamp on the organization, so to speak?
Todd more or less abided by what has already been established and tried desperately hard to keep up with it and take it a step or two further forward. And it was transition time again. In some aspects of the universities that were coming up with, we got, instead of universities, we got private laboratories who wanted to go down. We had scientists medical doctors who wanted to go down and try about finding out a cure for a sudden infant death syndrome. And they did it with the help of Jerry Koyman and his biology and work and with seals.
Who was that? Warren Zapol?
Who?
Was that Dr. Warren Zapol, Mass General? Warren Zapol pinned things on backs of seals?
Oh, yes. They pronounce his name differently.
Yeah.
Zapol,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I couldn't figure out who you were talking about. And Jerry did some wonderful things. He asked one time up at Skyline, he asked me about breastfeeding. And I said, well, you know, I said, it's a good thing, because I had a daughter. She was breastfed. And I said, you know, I said, Jerry, I said, I get you a breast pump, I said. And what you do is you get the mother seal, I said, and if you could without her killing you, get some milk from her and then feed him. So he did, and we fixed this thing up. We were like a belt in these little bottles with the breastfed milk in them, and he would kneel down in the snow and he'd get the baby to come over and suckle from the bottle while the mother went out to feed, because she'd be gone out a long, you know, couple of weeks. And so anyway, it was after that that we decided they were going to dive down there. And I said, well, we're going to dive in wetsuits. Well, we had a couple of bad turns there where Peter Gimbel from the Macy's and Gimbel's dynasty people, he didn't want to go into the business, although he did get, he had a share in it, but he wasn't running it. He wanted to get into science, and he was in science, and he was diving to trying to raise the Andrea Dorier that sunk off New York Harbor. So he went down with a couple of guys from New York University, and they did scuba diving down there. But they wanted to get down deeper. And the Command of Naval Support Force Antarctica was George Reedy. Mm-hmm. He didn't like that. Well, we had to convert him to this, but it's not going to be all military. We're not going to be like the Argentinians and the Chileans who want territorial position. I said, that's not going to happen. I said, it cannot happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't. Because then, you know, we were getting noise from mining, oil diggers, diamonds. I said, hell, we ain't going to get that. We're done down there. It's going to be a laboratory for promoting a research, basic scientific research, not applied or clinical. And that's what I mean, because that is the foundations, basics research, not clinical or applied. Clinical and applied goes to National Institutes of Health.
Mm-hmm.
And so we maintain we were a small boat in the pond, but what we did was remembered. And from many, many things came from that.
Yeah. Well, you worked you retired under Ed Todd, correct?
Yeah.
Well, you were quite young when you retired, weren't you?
54.
54. Why did you retire that early?
Because my husband had enough points in to get out. He had 85 and I had 80. So I decided, he said, I'm going to retire. He said, you want to come with me, he said, or not? He's been so tolerant.
Who did he work with?
He was an engineer. He had a master's degree. He was taught by the president of General Electric from Schenectady, New York,
mm-hmm.
who came down and with his GI Bill, he went and got his master's. And he was the engineer who constructed the Federal Aviation Building, the NASA's Space Museum, and he did organized with 19 different buildings mm-hmm. that housed the State Department. They wanted them all to get together on computers. So my husband worked on that and got them all tied up into one. And he went down and he was an engineer. He would be down there 2 weeks and then come home, change his clothes, spend the weekend with my daughter and myself, and then go back there. He was building the Dulles Airport. He did a flight control tower, built a credit union in the NASA building and also in the Federal Aviation building.
And so he worked, he was civil servant.
He was civil servant.
And he worked for which agency?
Federal Aviation.
FAA. Okay, I understand.
Right. And then he went and was an engineer on the subway construction under Washington,
mm-hmm.
D.C., and going into Virginia and into Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you do after you retired, the two of you?
We studied the weather for the last 10 years back in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
We decided he was going to take the television antenna from the roof and keep walking west. And he said, the first one that said, what the hell is that? He said, that's where we're going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
We went to a little town called Wickenburg, Arizona, named after a philologist who was German.
Mm-hmm.
Came and bought up land over there, settled and made that territory, and there you have it. And that's where we retired.
I see. So you spent most of your retirement years there in Arizona then. What, after your husband died, you moved here? Or?
No, we lived there 5 years, and he had arthritis very badly, and the doctor said, you have to take him to a place where there are four seasons. So we had a daughter who worked, went to school in Michigan, then she went to the University of Idaho. And when she got through there, she went down then to a civilian job and running the bank at the Marine Base in California. And then they moved. Her husband was worked in electronics, and he was transferred to Colorado. And so I called her up, and I said, we're moving. Try to find us a place in Colorado. She lived in Thornton, Colorado, in North Glen. I said, fine. She found us a house. We upped and moved.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband was hospitalized for double pneumonia and pleurisy. And so I got him out of there, and we moved to Colorado. And he contacted cancer and I.
Yeah, so he died in Colorado.
Yeah. October the 16th, 1988.